Now we take a look at the Supreme Court race here in Wisconsin. Last week's nonpartisan statewide primary election narrowed the candidates down to Justice Rebecca Bradley and Joanne Kloppenburg.
Yesterday, Milwaukee Judge Joe Donald released a statement that he's endorsing Kloppenburg. Donald ran in the primary last week and got 12% of the vote, which wasn't enough to keep him in the race.
Molly Beck joins us now to talk about this election. She's a reporter who covers politics and state government for the Wisconsin State Journal. Molly, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the phrase wake-up call for conservatives appeared in your piece on this. Why is this a wake-up call for conservatives?
Well, I think Rebecca Bradley, who was appointed by Governor Walker last fall, she's backed by conservatives, and it sounds like there was, you know, a feeling that she would at least get 50% of the vote in the primary or more. And instead, she received 45% of the vote, which was just about 2 percentage points ahead of Joanne Kloppenburg. So the race ended up being a lot closer than I think, observers from on both sides thought it would be.
Now, this is a nonpartisan election officially, so candidates for Supreme Court judge, just like mayor, county executive, things like that, don't register as part of a party. But that's the theory. In reality, it seems like all of these races break down to a conservative and a liberal candidate. This one seems to be no exception.
Right. Yes. Joanne Kloppenburg in 2011, ran a race against David Prosser, and Prosser prevailed in that race. But she was, you know, backed by the Greater Wisconsin Committee, which spent a lot on her behalf. And they, you know, are a liberal group. And so far in this race, the Wisconsin Alliance for Reform, which is a conservative group, has spent money for radio and TV advertisements for Rebecca Bradley. So while it's officially nonpartisan, you know, outside interest groups that have, you know, they lean one way or the other, they get involved. And to voters, you know, the candidates might be perceived as being partisan because of that.
You mentioned an outside group spending on behalf so far of Rebecca Bradley. Is it anticipated that in the general election there will be more spending for her, but also some equivalent levels of spending on the other side?
Yeah. I think, you know, I haven't heard back from the Greater Wisconsin Committee about, you know, what their plans are, but they did spend, you know, on behalf of Judge Kloppenburg in 2011, and, you know, observers expect that'll happen again. And, you know, the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, they usually get in these races, too. So it's expected that they'll spend on behalf of Bradley, too.
Now, were funders and these groups waiting to see how the primary came out as a signal of, I guess, whether it's worth spending money on this race?
Right, yeah. Up until the primary, the only outside group that had spent was the Wisconsin Alliance for Reform on Justice Bradley, on behalf of Justice Bradley. And some of the Democratic, you know, strategists that I spoke to said they needed to see, you know, how you know, Judge Joe Donald and Joanne Kloppenburg, what percentage of the vote they would receive. And a lot of them said that Joanne Kloppenburg overperformed, and that might be a signal to these groups that, you know, it's worth spending the money. Justice Bradley might not be a foregone conclusion like maybe they thought before.
And looking at the numbers you mentioned, a 2 percentage point difference between the two candidates, and then the third place finisher, Joe Donald, got about 12% of the vote, and now he's endorsed Joanne Kloppenburg. Is there a thought, talking to strategists on either side of this, that the votes that were for him are a gimme for Kloppenburg?
You know, no one has said that definitively. I know that when I spoke with Judge Kloppenburg the night of the primary, she said she was, you know, she was certainly going to go after those voters. And I think some would say that they, you know, expect a chunk of them to be aligned with, you know, liberal ideals and consider themselves Democrats, so they might go her way. But everybody also says, you know, you just never know, because Judge Joe Donald wasn't as well known as Justice Bradley and Judge Kloppenburg, especially in terms of his politics.
Now, this was a primary in a spring nonpartisan election, not known for high turnout. The general election is going to be at the same time as the primary, the presidential primary, when that comes here to Wisconsin. How are people on both sides of this weighing the impact of that?
Yeah, I think depending where, you know, the Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders campaigns are at, and, you know, on the Republican side, too, if it, those are, you know, both fiercely contested, you know, races at this point, but both or one of them could be a little bit more decided by then, you know, after Super Tuesday. But, you know, if it's still, you know, kind of up in the air on the Republican side, I think Republicans are expecting a lot, you know, of new voters and turnout to kind of balloon because of, you know, the impact of Donald Trump on that, you know, in that contest. And the same goes for Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. You know, I think people on both sides are expecting, you know, turnout to be much higher than it was, obviously, than it was in the primary. And the electorate will look a lot different. And, it, you know, depending where both of those races are, it could give the advantage to one side, or to Judge Kloppenberg or to Justice Bradley.
We're talking to Molly Beck from the Wisconsin State Journal about the Supreme Court race here in Wisconsin.
And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Which candidate are you supporting and why? And what issues are the most important to you in this race? You can call in right now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation right now with Molly Beck, a reporter from the Wisconsin State Journal. We're talking about the Supreme Court race in Wisconsin, and you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What issues are defining this race for you? Which candidate do you think is best, and what would you like to see covered in the two debates coming up? You can call us at 800-642-1234.
And Molly, Scott Walker, still governor of the state, of course, and he is playing a part in this race, maybe not intentionally. How are people trying to use him one way or another between the two candidates there?
Sure. You know, up until the primary, you saw opponents using the fact that Governor Walker appointed Justice Bradley, you know, three times in as many years to judgeships as, you know, pointing to her being partisan because of that. And it seems to be a strategy to, you know, when you mention Justice Bradley, you mention Governor Walker on the part of opponents. And so, you know, that was a question after the results of the primary came down that, you know, is Governor Walker hurting Justice Bradley given his approval rating among Wisconsin voters right now? I think the last Marquette Law School poll was about, he's at about 38%. Mm-hmm. So when you talk to Democrats, they will say definitely, you know, Republicans can't underestimate, you know, how badly the governor is going to drag her down. But when you talk to Republicans, they're, you know, they say that's not going to be the case, that voters aren't going to associate the two and they're going to just look at the candidate.
And you mentioned, I think it was some Republicans saying, hey, they've tried this before when Kloppenberg ran against David Prosser,
right,
who was on the Supreme Court, and Prosser's still on the Supreme Court.
Right, yes, yeah. In 2011, you know, that was all about Governor Walker, you know, if you talk to Republicans, and, you know, he still prevailed, David Prosser still prevailed. The governor's approval rating was a little bit higher at that point than it is right now, but that's still true that, you know, that race was kind of a referendum on the governor, and the conservative back candidate won.
One thing that's tricky about these Supreme Court races is the actual job that they're going to have is to rule on a bunch of stuff, but in the campaign they can't say things like, here's how I would rule on these various issues. So what?
Right.
How do the candidates, how are they portraying themselves? How are their campaigns portraying them as good potential justices?
Sure. Yeah. You know, when you talk to the candidates, they, you know, they stick to that message that this is a nonpartisan race. This is a nonpartisan position. You know, each of them say, I'm going to rule, you know, according to my judicial philosophy and, you know, the politics that kind of get injected into this race won't matter to the candidate. However, you have, you know, all these groups, these outside groups that are injecting themselves into the race. And for voters, it's kind of hard to, you know, to evaluate that and to know, you know, which candidate do I really want, which candidate, if they want a nonpartisan candidate, you know, which one is that, even though there's, you know, conservative backed groups backing one candidate and liberal groups backing the other. So voters end up kind of ironically looking for cues according to those groups and what they think because they are backing the candidates.
What do you make so far of the tone of the race? Has it been mostly, here's a good, positive, qualified candidate, or have there been attacks between the campaigns or from the outside groups so far?
Sure. So far it's been mostly about whether the candidates are partisan, you know, whether if they are truly independent and would, you know, approach their job in the Supreme Court that way. And I think that's, you know, I would say much of the focus has been on Justice Bradley because of her appointments from Governor Walker. We'll see, you know, how this progresses. I'm sure that there will be other factors that will come into play.
And, of course, candidates will be looking for endorsements from various groups. Mm-hmm. I think one of the experts you talked to mentioned things like law enforcement groups playing roles. Have they been making their choices yet? What do we know so far?
Well, actually, today the Wisconsin Professional Police Association endorsed Judge Kloppenberg. But when I talked to some of the Republican observers of the race, they said that law enforcement communities are really, they're supporting Rebecca Bradley. So we'll see, you know, official endorsements, how they come down. But as of today, that's who has, the WPPA has endorsed Judge Kloppenberg.
Getting back to the money side of things, are people expecting this to be a really big money kind of race, as we've seen sometimes in the past for the Supreme Court?
Yeah, I think I spoke to, WNC, who usually spends a lot pretty heavily in these races, and you know they said that they expect to spend, you know, at the same level as they have in the past, and I think in the last six elections they've spent a total of almost $6 million on races, and I think, you know, Democrats are expecting the Greater Wisconsin Committee to spend pretty heavily on behalf of Joan Kloppenberg this race too.
And briefly, how big a difference will the winner make on the balance of the court, the conservative-liberal split?
Right. It won't matter. The majority, it will still maintain a conservative majority regardless of who wins this race.
All right. We'll leave it there for now. Molly, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Molly Beck. She's a reporter who covers politics and state government for the Wisconsin State Journal. She joined us to talk about the latest in Wisconsin's race for the Supreme Court. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. The big news in Brazil this year was supposed to be the Summer Olympic Games, scheduled to start in August. But the countdown to the big event has been overshadowed by the outbreak of the Zika virus. The disease has spread rapidly in Brazil and beyond. It's believed to be linked to a rise in cases of microcephaly in newborns.
Our next guest says, given the threat of Zika, the International Olympic Committee should be ready for a change of plans, moving, postponing, or canceling the Rio Olympics. He's co-written two pieces recently on the Forbes website. Lee Eagle joins us now. He's clinical associate professor and co-director of sports and society at the New York University School of Professional Studies, also an associate of the Division of Medical Ethics at the NYU Langone Medical Center. Lee, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Good afternoon. Good to talk with you.
Make the case for us, Lee. Why do you want to see a change of plans for the Brazil Olympics?
Well, the real piece of it is that you've got in Brazil a tough economy, a turbulent economy, a turbulent political environment. Both of those are sitting on top of a really tough social condition, social situation. And to add to that, an Olympic Games and all that goes into that, that's one story. And then add to all of that, this Zika virus outbreak, and you've got something completely different. The questions are, where are you going to put resources? Where are you going to put financial resources? Where are you going to put human resources?
So shouldn't we leave it to, I don't know, individual athletes and tourists to decide if games are worth going, if how they feel about that resource division?
Well, there's certainly certainly everybody is responsible for himself or herself. But there's got to be some thinking from the decision makers in organizations like the International Olympic Committee, maybe even in the individual nations Olympic associations, certainly in the Brazilian government, and really for any stakeholders like sponsors, and anybody who's got a real hand in the Olympics, to think through and start to make decisions about what extent it's really advisable to go through with it, and realize that there's a tall order there in even suggesting to suspend or postpone the Olympics, no less to cancel them. But this is there's a real human situation, a human condition here that's got to be considered.
Some people would say this is overreaction, maybe a panic based on this disease that in a world of many diseases maybe isn't as bad as some others.
Well, the tough thing is that there's a lot about Zika that we know. It's been around for a number of decades, but there's plenty more about it that we don't know. So this is a virus that's already spreading, and bringing people into Brazil, having them move around Brazil, and then many of them going back out just adds to a problem that if you speak to people in Brazil, especially in the areas where the virus is really at an outbreak state, there's real reason to be concerned.
The head of the World Health Organization's Zika response team said last week there's a bit of good news. August is winter in Brazil. Mosquito activity should be down. That should slow down the spread of the disease. He says, hey, Brazil can host a fantastic Olympics. Does that go anywhere to reassure you that maybe this should go ahead as planned?
Well, again, if you break apart all these issues, then they're really probably shouldn't be too much concern, because the Brazilians are actually quite good at managing a virus outbreak like this. They've done it before. The question really is about one thing on top of another, on top of another, on top of another, on top of another. So it's you just look at Brazil's economic situation, which Brazil is going through its worst economic time since the 1930s. That's really doing some turbulent things to the politics there. Socially, Brazil is having a tough time, and to put the Olympics there in the first place is one thing. There's an enormous amount of coordination that goes into it. Certainly stress on the infrastructure, on healthcare systems and the like. But now we're seeing stories, for example, about Olympic venues where for water sports, where there were promises that the filthy water would be cleaned up. And at this point, this many months far out, they've sort of thrown up their hands and said, we're not going to be able to get it done. It's just not going to happen. So the kinds of things that we're looking at is taking this sort of, if you will, a perfect storm with the economy, with the politics, with the social condition, putting an Olympics in the mix, and then this virus outbreak. Again, if you break all of those apart, there's a good argument that they're manageable. Put them all together, now we're talking about a different story.
Talking to Lee Eagle from New York University, he's making the case that in Brazil, amidst the Zika virus, and he says other problems going on there, we should be thinking, the International Olympic Committee should be thinking of postponing, moving, canceling maybe the Rio Olympics. So, Lee, you're talking about this, where do the resources go with the conditions already there, with the Zika virus, but a lot of the resources have already gone. A lot has already gone into building the sites, changing the infrastructure there. And so that's, I guess, going to all be lost if this gets canceled or moved. So is that an incentive to keep this on track as planned?
Well, we can go ahead and continue going with it. And I think by the looks of it, knowing how these things go and the decision makers involved, barring something catastrophic and unforeseen, the Olympics will go on. But to that, we're not talking about something that has to do with just money and how much is going to get lost if the Olympics don't go on. There's a real human situation that's got to be considered here, and it really is a question of money versus people.
Well, big picture, isn't that always an argument and a balancing act in the Olympics, wherever they are? There's concerns about people being relocated from often low-income areas to build the infrastructure. That's happened in Rio. It's happened elsewhere. Concerns that, hey, money could be better spent on local social, economic, health conditions. I mean, ultimately, we could question any Olympic site just about.
Sure, and tell you, I'm actually a big believer that that sports is a pathway to development and it can be done in a productive way. So these are good things that can happen. It takes longer to see some of the softer kind of thing. People tend to look at economic impact studies and make decisions off of that. My approach is much more take the economic impact studies and then mix in human beings, people, social situations, which tends to be the soft stuff. So it's not a question of that in this situation. It's really a question of people and their health. This isn't so much a question of economics and finances as much as it is about society and people's health.
Well, on a related note, on Facebook, we heard from Sarah, who was wondering, how is this worse than other diseases transmitted by mosquitoes? Malaria, dengue, West Nile virus, yellow fever, encephalitis. Her list goes on quite a bit. So, I mean, what is it about Zika that makes it the last straw here that these other diseases we weren't thinking about?
Well, I sort of chuckled that not because any of this is funny, but because there is a long list of viruses, and you can sort of go, okay, enough's enough. So you ask this great question, and it's not Zika per se. It's, again, coming back to what's going on in Brazil already, adding the Olympics to that, and then the virus outbreak. So you're really talking about further stressing infrastructure, further stressing healthcare systems, further stressing the finances that are moving in and around Brazil. And then we've got to think about all the people who would come in as tourists, to an earlier question. But it's not just about athletes who have to make a decision. And there's not an easy decision, but a clear-cut decision that women who are pregnant or who think they might become pregnant before too long probably ought not to go there on the chance of becoming infected. But we're learning more and more about this disease that certainly men who become infected can probably transfer the disease to a sexual partner. And again, we're still getting information coming in about how this disease evolves. So there's a great deal that we actually don't know about, and it's starting to show up with some other symptoms that hadn't really been seen before. So it's not to panic. We don't do that. We don't throw things out there. I mean, people panic. We're cautious about even writing something like Arthur Kaplan and I wrote. But it really is to put some serious caution out there about something that really hasn't, by the way, for most people in the United States, really come to cross our path. So again, talk to people in Brazil, and they'll tell you a very different story than people will hear in the United States.
Well, Lee, I was trying to think, can you think of any precedent for this kind of decision to maybe cancel a major sporting event? All I can think of is, you know, the boycott of the Olympics in the Soviet Union after the Afghanistan invasion. Not a disease issue, but something that led to a lot of countries, including the United States, bailing out of an Olympic Games. Any other precedents leap to mind for you?
Beyond that, the only other precedent we get is during a world war. During wartime, we've seen the games, postponement, cancellation, conversations around that, and that actually happening. But in the context of a virus outbreak, we haven't seen it, and so on its face, on the surface, seems kind of absurd, you know. But there is some precedent to it. The difference is, in the past, it's been political. This time, it's much more social. It's much more human.
Lee, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Very good talk with you. Thanks for having me on.
That was Lee Eagle from New York University. We've got a link to one of his pieces on Zika and the Olympics on the Central Time Facebook page.